This is Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Expert hosts like William Henry on secrets of the past, Jim Mars on politics and conspiracy, Ann Strieber on matters of the spirit, and Whitley Strieber on aliens, UFOs, and who knows what else. And weekly science reporter, Emmy Award winner Linda Moulton Howe. We say it like it is. We take you deeper, down where the real secrets lie. Dreamland. Welcome to the edge of the world.
Howdy, this is Jim Mars, and I'm your host today on Dreamland. And today we have a guest that is a personal favorite of mine, somebody I greatly respect for his research, for his knowledge, and for his ability to put it all down in the written word, and that is Joseph P. Farrell. He's the author of the trilogy about the Giza Death Star. He's the author of The Cosmic War. He's the author of The Reich of the Black Sun and the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And today we're going to be talking about his latest book, Secrets of the Unified Field. And I think this gets to the very heart of cutting-edge physics, cutting-edge science today, and even into Stranger Things, which leads me to my first question, which is, Joseph, welcome to the program.
Hey, Jim, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty lovely.
Well, thanks for having me back on.
I know a lot of our listeners for years have been fascinated with the story of the Philadelphia experiment, the USS Eldridge, and that was 1943, wasn't it?
That's correct. About the middle of October, tail end of September, towards the middle of October, that supposedly happened.
Right. Well, first off, can you succinctly and just briefly, kind of for those who are not familiar with the Philadelphia experiment, and I'm not sure who that would be because there's been several books written and even a movie, or actually two movies, I think, made about it. But just in capsule form, tell us what the basic story of the Philadelphia experiment.
Well, basically the way that I kind of piece it together based on an examination of the evidence plus some scientific papers and so on, is that the U.S. Navy during World War II began a series of experiments that was designed to lead to making a ship invisible to radar and also probably to be able to cause a certain extent of deflection of projectiles and torpedoes. And, of course, that was a necessary step for the American invasion of Europe. But in the course of the experiment, the way that I tend to view the experiment and what's been written about it by the primary sources that talk about it is that at some point and for some reason, the experiment crossed some sort of threshold that the planners didn't really realize existed. And as a result of that, the entire ship became invisible to normal eyesight, as well as simply invisible to radar. And there are, of course, stories that grew up after this primary story that suggested that the ship had actually been teleported and that there were certain temporal displacements, movements of the ship in time, and so on and so forth. I wasn't able to find any evidence in the original version of the story that suggested that, although there were certainly plenty of other strange things associated with it.
Right. So tell me, what have you found in your research that, number one, substantiates the reality of the Philadelphia experiment, and number two, that convinces you that something very unusual did take place?
Well, that to me was the most peculiar aspect of the story, Jim, because I'd always known about the Philadelphia experiment and been fascinated by it and knew I'd probably have to write a book about it someday, but I didn't do it with much enthusiasm because of all of the sort of extraneous legend that had been attached to it after the original story. But what I really did in the book was I went back over the primary story very carefully, and one of the things that the originator of the story, Carlos Allende, of course, that he mentioned time and again in his letters to Dr. Jessup was that the experiment had been rationalized on the basis of some version of Einstein's unified field theory. And I got to thinking about the type of data that Allende alleges occurred to the ship. Of course, I've already mentioned optical invisibility, but he also mentions very strange things, that the crew of the ship were embedded in some sort of field within a field, and that when exposed to magnetic fields, some of the crew members would actually simply disappear or get stuck, so to speak, and not be able to move. So I began looking at Einstein's unified field theories, and one version in particular stuck out as being a possible basis for all those kinds of effects, and that was the version that he wrote in 1928. Now, for your listeners who are kind of interested in this sort of thing, the 1928 version of his theory incorporated a mathematical expression called the torsion tensor. And what torsion does is, if you can imagine taking an aluminum soda pop can and then emptying it and then wringing it like a dish rag in your hands, torsion does that to the fabric of space-time. It folds and bends and spirals and pleats space-time. So you could rationalize scientifically, on the basis of that particular mathematical expression, some of the results of the experiment, the optical displacements, the alleged temporal displacements, and so on and so forth. And the other thing I did was I started to examine the work of a little-known Hungarian electrical engineering genius by the name of Gabriel Krohn. Krohn wrote a paper in 1935 that won him a prize from the University of Liège in Belgium. And basically, in this paper, he proposed the idea that certain anomalies that electrical engineers are familiar with, the creep of electrical systems when they're networked, and particularly rotating electrical machines, he proposed that you could rationalize this behavior and account for it on the basis of that particular version of Einstein's unified field theory. Now, Jim, this is a breathtaking thing for Krohn to have said, because what he really is implying is that that 1928 unified field theory was engineerable on the laboratory bench, and as a result of that, that you could engineer the fabric of space-time locally. So Krohn makes his way over to the United States, and it's my guess that his work had come not only to the attention of the Nazis in Germany, but of course to the scientists in the American military, and that this ultimately formed the rationale for the basis of the experiment.
Wow. So what we're basically talking about here is the manipulation of energy at the atomic and even subatomic level.
Well, yes, but there's another part to this theory, and that is that it really deals with things in the very large. In other words, things on the order of a ship or so on and so forth. But again, according to Krohn, what you could use this theory to do is explain this anomalous behavior that many electrical engineers are familiar with when they're dealing with large networked electrical systems. You can explain it on the basis of this particular mathematical expression that Einstein incorporated in his 1928 theory. So yes, what he's really saying is, pick any level that you want to manipulate space-time at, and you do have a way of doing so if you configure electrical systems in a particular way.
So, in other words, this is the practical application
right.
of this energy manipulation.
Absolutely. That's
which,
absolutely correct.
And at the heart of it lies Einstein's unified field theory, which, to be very simplistic, basically says that the entire universe, everything that we know, is basically nothing more than energy.
Well, that's one implication, and there's yet another that's rather interesting. Because if you go back and consider general relativity deals with a geometry of gravity that effectively reduces its effects to the physics of the very large on the scale of planets and stars and so on. So that in general relativity, you don't have any way of manipulating that fabric without a very large mass being present. But in his 1928 unified field theory, with this particular mathematical expression, what he really does is he abandons that whole quest because what he's trying to do is unify electromagnetism and gravity. So when he does this, one of the things that he makes possible is very small local variations of gravitation and magnetic anomalies. In other words, in a certain sense, his theory makes possible anomalous regions of the Earth like the Bermuda Triangle and so on. And that's kind of one of the strange things I found out when I researched this book. Because if you plot out the logs of the Terrazet, which was the ship on which Allende served, you discover that by the time he reaches the Eldridge and its location, it's located very close, if not actually in the Bermuda Triangle, when all these strange effects occurred.
Incredible. Yes, that's one of the aspects of your book that really struck me. Well, we're going to pause now for a little break, and we'll be back with Joseph P. Farrell right after this.
This is Whitley Strieber. Listen to this conversation with Joseph Farrell.
We've touched on the bell many times.
Right.
On the idea that this object moved through time into Kecksburg in Pennsylvania. And literally the object that fell, what was the year it fell in Kecksburg?
1965.
In 1965 had just a few moments before that left, what was it, Poland in, or Germany?
Well, at the time it would have been in Germany. Silesia now is in Poland, but
yeah,
time,
that's right.
Part of Germany.
It would have been in Silesia in early 1945.
Possibly so.
Yes.
That's an excerpt from this week's offering for Unknown Country subscribers. Every week, something just as new, just as fascinating. Plus, as a subscriber, you get access to every Dreamland recorded for the past 5 years, hundreds of subscriber interviews, access to live chats with celebrity guests, and our vibrant subscriber community. We believe that this is by far the best offering of its kind on the Internet. So go to unknowncountry.com and click on that subscribe tab right now.
This week only, if you act fast, you'll get free the Quantum Mind of God DVD. Frequent Dreamland guest Philip Gardner explores meaning, God, and the new physics. Subscribe for a year after 6 a.m. Saturday morning, and you might get this great premium.
So click on that subscribe tab right away and join our community.
The Nye Incidents. It's out at last and available from the unknowncountry.com store. Not from our Amazon store, but from our original unknowncountry.com store. So you can get it directly from us by clicking on the store tab and going either to Whitley's Books or to the latest. It's selling out in stores nationwide, so do get it soon because I'm not sure we'll be able to get any more copies. The Nye Incidents is about a group of incidents that I believe really took place in either northern New Jersey or New York State about 5 or 6 years ago that involved human mutilations. Was it a murderer? A serial killer? Was it them? Well, explore these fears with me and with Lynn Devlin, the main character of the Nye Incidents in this graphic novel, powerfully written based on my story by Craig Spector and drawn by Gus Floor. It's high impact, high intensity, a terrific graphic novel created out of a very hidden and very strange reality. Get it from the unknowncountry.com store right now.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online with guest host Jim Mars.
And today we're having a really knock-your-socks-off conversation with author Joseph P. Farrell about the manipulation of energy. Under careful scrutiny of the original documents and government files and reports, am I understanding that the whatever happened to the Eldridge did not happen in the Philadelphia Navy Yard?
Oh no, that's one of the real things that popped out at me, Jim, when I first started doing this book, because if you sit down and read Allende very carefully and very closely, he maintains over and over again that the full upscale version of the experiment was performed at sea. So in other words, you know, the idea that it was performed in a dockyard is part of the legend that grew up after the original story. Now, it happens to be a part that makes a bit of sense to me, because if we're going to have an experiment or project like this taking place, you can bet your bottom dollar that the Navy's not going to put all this fancy equipment on a ship and sail out to sea and just perform the experiment. No. What they're going to do is a series of proof-of-concept experiments on a small scale prior to the full-scale version. And it's because of the success of those experiments that they tried to do this at sea, and that's where they crossed that threshold that they don't know exists, and all of these strange results happen as a result of it.
So there was not just one Philadelphia experiment, there was a series.
Right. To me, Jim, the term Philadelphia experiment really refers to a project. And as, you know, any scientific project, you're going to have kind of a proof of concept experiment on the small scale. And if that works, then you pitch the whole full-scale version to whoever is going to be financially backing it. And it stands to reason then that if indeed the Navy did this experiment, and I think they did, that their rationalization is going to be, well, we'll try this on a small scale first. And probably what they did was that they used some of the Navy's small-scale models that they used in the Taylor Model Basin over in Maryland and performed small-scale experiments on those things and discovered, well, this whole concept does have some merit, so we might as well pursue this. And, you know, from a certain standpoint, Jim, during the war, as crazy as the experiment sounds, that during the war, it would have really been dereliction of duty if the Navy had not pursued something like that. So, you know, all the scientific evidence and evidence that Allende presents point to a very strong circumstantial case that the Navy did, in fact, perform this experiment.
Right, exactly. And, of course, in the extingencies of wartime, as you say, they'd be derelict not to.
Right.
Before we go back into the unified field theory, let's move to the other side of World War II.
Okay.
Am I correct in assuming that this same type of energy manipulation and vortex energy was being experimented on by the Nazis, particularly within their Bell project? Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, yes, I think that one and the same physics is involved in both projects. The difference between the two is if you look at what I say in the new book, if you take
That's
all
the secrets of the unified field, folks.
Yeah, if you take all of the clues that are in the literature about the Bell and kind of put them all together, what you have, I think, again, is the Germans probably were very aware of Gabriel Krohn's work, as if they hadn't made similar conclusions themselves already. And as a result of that consideration, they rationalized the Bell project as a project to study the effects of using rotating electromagnetic fields and plasmas and so on to manipulate the fabric of space-time. So in other words, again, I go back to my basic observation that the Bell represents a kind of a prototype technology that is designed to investigate that physics that could lead and was designed by the Germans to do or lead to one of three possible things all at the same time, namely zero-point energy manipulation, a kind of a field propulsion for advanced aircraft, and then finally, as of course, a weapon. So I think in a certain sense, the Germans probably rationalized their Bell project much more thoroughly than we did the Philadelphia experiment. But by the same token...
In other words, they planned for these things that happened, and we did not. We just kind of happened upon it.
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think the Germans knew that there were going to be very strange effects. But if you go back to what I wrote in SS Brotherhood of the Bell, on the initial test of the device, seven of the German scientists that were involved in that initial test died. So even though they may have expected some strange effects, I don't think that they at first appreciated the strength of those effects.
Kind of got away from them, too.
Right, exactly. So in other words, both countries have a certain amount of presumptuousness at work in their experiments, and by the same token, I think both countries tried to rationalize them as carefully as they could, And in both cases, at some point, the experiment initially ran away from them and achieved some very bizarre effects that they weren't expecting. And as a result of that, I think in terms of the Philadelphia project, the project was probably not canceled. It simply disappeared into a much blacker compartment of the government. In
right.
the case of the Germans and their Bell, I think probably what it did was it divided, if you study the record carefully, it divided the project into two components, one dealing with the physics aspect and then another medical aspect that was designed to study how they could limit the effects of that field.
Mm-hmm. And if my research is correct and my assumptions are correct, then that both of those aspects of this energy manipulation study may have come together in post-war America. So then they really had something they could work with.
Well, this is one of the strange things. I end Secrets of the Unified Field with a discussion of what I think are two extremely strange things. And one of them is actually based on a picture that Berlitz and Moore include in their book on the Philadelphia experiment called Project Invisibility. And it's a picture of the original Navy officers that Allende sent a marked-up version of Morris Jessup's book on UFOs to. And in addition to these gentlemen, you find the president of the company that the Navy contacted to publish a short-run version of Jessup's book with Allende's markings. Okay? You find him present in this picture. But the strangest presence in that picture is sitting on the opposite side of the table, almost by himself, like he's holding court or something. And that's Dr. Werner von Braun. Now, I found that extremely interesting because in the course of examining all these disparate pieces of evidence, you find out that this edition that the Navy had specially printed of Dr. Jessup's UFO book was, according to them, circulated among their top people. And there in that picture, you have suggested to you who some of those top people were, and one of them is a former Nazi rocket scientist.
Werner von Braun.
Werner von
right.
Braun.
Yes, absolutely amazing. You know, Joseph, what really jumped right out of the pages of the Secrets of the Unified Field to me was when you described the swastika
uh-huh.
as a counterclockwise rotating vectors and stress diagram that you refer to as the swastika tensor.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's just some kind of weird synchronicity, or do you think that as far back as the 20s, when the swastika was adopted as the Nazi emblem in Germany, that they somehow in some way were aware of this vortex energy and may have actually, you know, planned for that and as a little clue to what they were into?
Well, I think it's the latter. I think that they were aware of the physics involved. And most importantly, I'm going to disclose a little bit here about a new book I have at a publisher right now. It's called The Philosopher's Stone, and then the subtitle to that is called The American Gold, The Soviet Mercury, and The Nazi Serum.
Wow.
And one of the things I do in that book, I'm not going to give out the specifics right now until the book comes out, but I can kind of generally indicate what the Nazi section deals with. It deals with the all-pervasive influence of alchemical teaching in the background thinking of some of those pre-war German secret societies, and most importantly, I document very explicitly how that thinking influenced the immediate circle of the Reichsfuhrer of the SS, namely Heinrich Himmler.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you have an esoteric component to this physics that I think definitely the Nazis were investigating. And, you know, if you have a serious scientist like Dr. Walter Gerlach, who is the project head of the Bell, sort of exposed not only to that way of thinking, but who himself is investigating those types of areas of physics, all he would have had to have done, as I point out in Secrets of the Unified Field, in order to sell the project to the Nazis was just to say, well, looky here, your own corporate logo, so to speak, is an ideogram of exactly what I'm talking about.
Right, right. This is kind of getting off on a tangent, but,
sure.
You know, people have asked me for years, did the Nazis recover a flying saucer and back engineer it to get some of their super sophisticated technology that we have evidence now of? And I never could find any hard evidence to suggest that they physically recovered some object. But what I and several other researchers have kind of come to the belief is that they may indeed, by using and understanding this type of unified field energy manipulation, mm-hmm. they may have used something akin to remote viewing, which we used in our Army,
right.
In the U.S. Army for about 25 or 30 years, and or what the some of the psychics call channeling.
Right.
Do you feel like that's possible in view of your work with this unified field, that they were able to actually contact non-human intelligences to pick up tips on new technology?
Well, that is an extremely intriguing question, Jim. And to be honest with you, I considered the possibility of these recovered craft and back engineering things that have been floating out there on the internet and in other circles about the Nazis for some years. And like you, I could not find any hard evidence that seemed to substantiate that. But what I did find, and I even mentioned this very briefly in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and again, I'm writing a new book right now in which I deal with this subject very directly. What I did find was that in some of those secret society circles, you do have the claim, put out, incidentally, I should add, by some post-war neo-Nazi circles. So again, you have to kind of view it with a degree of skepticism.
Right.
But nonetheless, the claim exists that in some of these secret societies, precisely was used by Nazis and psychics to contact a civilization about 8 light years from the Earth, as a matter of fact, and that contact resulted in the communication of some data to construct what they called a flying time machine, basically, in the German. So, yes, the story exists. I don't know to this date how much substantiation to put to it because I haven't been able to verify that story from any other sources other than that
right.
narrow circle of neo-Nazis. So,
well, isn't it true, though, that the Bell experiment had a code name of Kronos?
Yes, that's quite true.
Yeah, which would indicate that there was a time aspect to that, too. And, of course, time-traveling Nazis, that sounds like a grade B.
Yeah, it sounds like a grade B Hollywood thriller.
Well, we're going to pause now for a little break, and we'll be back with Joseph P. Farrell right after this.
Jim Marrs, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. Throw out everything you think you know about history. Forget the mass media. Forget what you've been told. And read The Rise of the Fourth Reich. After you read this book, the modern world and the state America is in suddenly begin to make a new kind of sense. If we are going to regain our freedom, we need to understand. The Rise of the Fourth Reich. Get it from Unknown Country's Amazon store.
Joseph Farrell's Secrets of the Unified Fields, the Continuing Menace of Nazi Secret Research. Listening to this today is a revelation. Get it from the unknowncountry.com Amazon store.
Every week, over 30,000 people get the free unknowncountry.com newsletter. Keep up with the latest about some of the world's most amazing stories. News you cannot get elsewhere. Sign up on unknowncountry.com. We keep all email addresses strictly private. The unknowncountry.com newsletter, unique in the world.
Howdy, this is Jim Marrs, and you're back here on Dreamland, and today we're having a really knock-your-socks-off conversation with author Joseph P. Farrell about the manipulation of energy. If you understand that there seems to be an interlocking relationship between gravity and time,
right,
then if you negate gravity, then you very conceivably are negating time.
Well, you're manipulating it to a degree, and that is certain. And again, let's go back to some of the effects that the Bell had on organic matter that was deliberately placed in its test environs. And for that matter, let's consider the effects of the Philadelphia experiment that Allende alleges for the crew of the Eldridge. In both cases, you have some very, very weird things happening to people exposed to the field. In the case of the Philadelphia experiment, you have people that just suddenly quite literally disappear, according to Allende, mm-hmm. if they're exposed to a weak magnetic field. In the case of the Bell, you have plants decaying to kind of a blackish-gray goo within a matter of mere days after their exposure to the device, and they do so without putrefaction. And again, that would suggest that in some sense, some sort of field was impressed upon the plants and sped up their metabolism, and they died. So in both cases, again, I think you can rationalize it, and I get into this in Secrets of the Unified Field, as the presence of torsion fields that can indeed be impressed into objects and remain there long after the field that sets them up has been switched off. So again, you know, it stands to reason that if you re-expose yourself, as Allende suggests, to similar effects that set up the original field, you're going to get some rather strange results. So again, I think all of the scientific rationalization is very plausible. But let's go back to that project code name, Kronos. There's another meaning of the word Kronos in the Greek, and that is Saturn. So, you know, he put that together with all the strange things that Richard Hoagland has found out about the planet Saturn in recent years.
Right.
And, you know, you've got yet another possibility for what the Nazis may have been up to.
Well, Joseph, not just to quickly interject, when you start bringing in the planet Saturn, and then you're talking about Bell and the Nazis in World War II and UFOs in outer space, we're kind of back to the unified field theory.
That's right.
It's
that's
all
right.
One big ball of wax.
That's right.
All right, excuse me, go ahead.
No, that was my point.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I was jumping you there. Okay, well, let's talk about the unified field theory, because today
sure.
Einstein is generally regarded for his theory of relativity, and
right.
Everybody knows E equals MC squared. But why do you suppose, and I know why I suppose, but why do you suppose that his unified theory, which may indeed be the crux of everything, may be the foundation of the whole universe, why was that denigrated and kind of swept under the rug?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One of them is the line that you would get from standard physics, namely that the unified field theories that Einstein and others were playing around with in the late 1920s and early 30s dealt with the unification of only two of the known physical forces, namely electromagnetism and gravity. But they did not deal with the emerging fields that quantum mechanics was discovering at the very small level of physics, and those are called the strong and weak nuclear forces.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you pursue that explanation, you eventually end up with the 26-dimensional monster string theory, you know, which is
actually gaining traction today.
Well, it's gaining a great deal of traction in this country. It's not on as firm a ground in Europe or Russia for reasons that are interesting in and of themselves. But, you know, the standard explanation is that string theory is really the only theory that, at least as a mathematical formalism, formally unifies all four of those theories, or fields, pardon me.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are other contenders in the American physics scene, loop quantum gravity and other types of theories that do this. But the real problem with string theory is, by its own admission, it's not a testable theory. It's more like a religious dogma, okay?
Right. You can put some diagrams on the chalkboard, but nobody's been able to make anything.
Right, right. Now, I think there's another explanation, though, for why these early 20s and 30s unified field theories were sidelined, and I think it is a conspiratorial reason. And that is, if you go back to what I've suggested about the work of Gabriel Krohn, which made those theories engineerable on the laboratory bench, so to speak, then it stands to reason that if there was any degree of success in doing that, namely the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell, it stands to reason that you're going to want to draw attention away from those theories by pointing out their inconsistencies and so on, all the while you are quietly and covertly continuing to investigate the implications.
And working on them yourself.
Right, exactly.
Kind of like anti-gravity, which it was
right.
Today, you know, you ask any conventional physicist and they'll roll their eyes and say, there ain't no such thing, and yet I know and you know that there are serious people doing serious work on anti-gravity, and in fact, with the ever-growing realization that there are things up there flying around that are not using propellers or ramjets, then
right.
It seems like that anti-gravity is actually being used by somebody somewhere.
Well, yes, exactly, and let's go back to one very obvious fact. If you take the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell, they're both performed at roughly the same period of history, and a funny thing happens to both projects at the end of the war. They disappear.
Right. They went away. It didn't happen, folks.
So, in other words, the implication is that somebody has had 60-plus years to perfect whatever physics and technology that those two experiments implied. So, you know, the sky really is the limit as to what you might be able to achieve with the investment of enough money and personnel in continuing those two projects.
That's correct. And let's don't, we won't even pursue the time travel. We could get into time anomalies and, you know, we could go on and on for that. But let's briefly, though, let's mention stargates.
Sure.
If you're able to fold the fabric of space and time, then it's certainly feasible that you could open a stargate to another universe or perhaps another dimension.
Well, that's true, and it's very interesting that you mention that, because yet another code name for the Nazi Bell project was Project Tor, which is, of course, the German word for gate.
Right. Exactly. Amazing. And the thing is, I don't know if you've, well, yeah, I know, you have gone back and looked at the ancient history, but I'm reminded of the biblical story of King Nebuchadnezzar, who, by the way, our establishment media has told us that Saddam Hussein believed himself the reincarnated Nebuchadnezzar. And he was
right.
Rebuilding Babylon, and he was obviously had a fixation on that ancient history and on that period in history. And what do we read in the Bible about King Nebuchadnezzar? He built a structure out of gold and apparently created energy fields within that, because when he put his people in it, they died. But when he put the three Hebrew priests in it, they not only lived, but suddenly there was a fourth person in there. Where did
right.
he come from?
Right, right. Well, you know, my take on all of this ancient stuff is that indeed many of these texts, including some of the biblical texts, are in fact describing a lost physics and technology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I still find, in fact, I just finished reading Lieutenant Colonel Bogdanos's book called The Thieves of Baghdad.
Right,
he was the Marine colonel.
For our listeners who don't know who Colonel Bogdanos is, he was the U.S. military officer, or the colonel, who investigated the looting, so-called looting, of the Iraqi National Museum towards the end of the invasion of Iraq back in 2003.
Right.
So
well, after reading that book, Jim, and I'm planning to put an article up pretty soon on my website about my reaction to that book. But basically, I can tell you that I am not satisfied after having read it that his explanation is of inside job and professionals simply retrieving artifacts to smuggle into the black market of antiquities.
To cover up a cover story.
Right. I think that there is something deeper going on, and there are certain passages in his book that indeed suggest that. But again, you know, all of this goings on in Iraq, and you and I have speculated on this before, and I think even on Dreamland, that the ultimate motivation of at least some of those looters was to recover ancient texts that might have given some clue into this lost science.
Right.
So So I think you have to hold open the possibility that there are all sorts of agendas going on over there besides the United States simply trying to get a forward base in the Middle East and control oil.
Right, exactly. Well, according to some of the scuttlebutt that I picked up from sources who claim to know, they actually did recover some not only artifacts but some tablets and things referring to ancient technology.
Right.
But they haven't quite been able to make them work.
I think, again...
Apparently there's still pieces missing from the puzzle.
Oh, yes, I think that there are missing pieces. But, you know, let's go back to what we were talking about with the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell and kind of tie it into this in a certain sense. Because, again, if you're working with a standard model of physics, you're not going to be able to read those texts and interpret them properly.
Right.
And, again, if you are working with some of these off-the-beaten-path models of physics that nevertheless very clearly exist, do exist, and that were tested, if you rationalize some of those ancient texts on that basis, then, indeed, they do begin to make sense. That's the part I find about that type of research that still kind of astonishes me and puzzles me.
Well, we're going to pause now for a little break, and we'll be back with Joseph P. Farrell right after this.
The Nye Incidents. It's out at last and available from the UnknownCountry.com store. Not from our Amazon store, but from our original UnknownCountry.com store. So you can get it directly from us by clicking on the store tab and going either to Whitley's Books or to the latest. It's selling out in stores nationwide, so do get it soon because I'm not sure we'll be able to get any more copies. The Nye Incidents is about a group of incidents that I believe really took place in either northern New Jersey or New York State about 5 or 6 years ago that involved human mutilations. Was it a murderer? A serial killer? Was it them? Well, explore these fears with me and with Lynn Devlin, the main character of the Nye Incidents in this graphic novel, powerfully written based on my story by Craig Spector and drawn by Gus Floor. It's high impact, high intensity, a terrific graphic novel created out of a very hidden and very strange reality. Get it from the UnknownCountry.com store right now.
Every week, over 30,000 people get the free UnknownCountry.com newsletter. Keep up with the latest about some of the world's most amazing stories. News you cannot get elsewhere. Sign up on UnknownCountry.com. We keep all email addresses strictly private. The UnknownCountry.com newsletter. Unique in the world.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online with guest host Jim Mars.
Joseph Farrell's Secrets of the Unified Fields, the Continuing Menace of Nazi Secret Research. Listening to this today is a revelation. Get it from the UnknownCountry.com Amazon store.
Howdy, this is Jim Mars, and you're back here on Dreamland, and today we're having a really knock your socks off conversation with author Joseph P. Farrell about the manipulation of energy. What you're saying is that if you read the New York Times or your local newspaper and listen to your network or local news, you don't hear anything about any of this. And
no.
As far as most people know, it just doesn't exist.
That's true. And
but somewhere, somebody is taking this very seriously and is proceeding with their experimentation, which I might add concerns me, Joseph, because lest none of us ever forget that when they set off the first atomic bomb at Alamogordo in 1945, more than half the scientists working on the Manhattan Project sincerely believed that they would not be able to stop a fission reaction and that it would ignite the atmosphere and incinerate the Earth. But they set it off anyway.
Yes, they set it off anyway.
And so, you know, now they're tampering with the building blocks of the universe, and God knows what could happen to us if something goes wrong.
Well, you know, I agree with you. This is the disturbing aspect about this area of physics, and those who have investigated it thoroughly, like Lieutenant Colonel Tom Bearden and others, have always warned that there are effects of the this physics that we do not yet understand, and they could backfire on us in a major planetary-sized way.
Not just the crew of one ship.
No, not exactly, and not, for that matter, a relatively small thing like setting off a hydrogen bomb. I mean, we're talking something truly major.
Setting off a hydrogen bomb, that's just a minor problem.
That's a minor little thing compared to some of this. But you know, I should point out in the new book, The Philosopher's Stone, that should be coming out sometime next spring. Basically, it's an examination of the alchemical roots of some of this off-the-beaten-path physics. And one of the things that is very clear, if you read some of these ancient alchemical texts, is precisely this caution that things can, if you don't be careful as to how you configure your transmutative experiments, things can kind of run away from you. So, you know, we have modern science and ancient alchemical texts say kind of the same thing.
That's right. But I was suddenly popped into my head was the European legend of the golem,
right?
You know, which they take base earth and create this living creature, but then it runs amok.
Right. Exactly. Exactly the same sort of thing is implied here.
Amazing.
And surprisingly, the clue that actually ties it together is precisely the testing of large-scale atmospheric hydrogen bombs that the United States and the Soviet Union did in the 1950s. And I get into that story, how that led into, particularly in the Soviet Union, led into some extremely classified research as to just why they were getting more yield from their bombs than they were calculating to give.
So. Exactly. In fact, as I recall, I guess it was in SS Brotherhood of Bell, if I remember correctly, you basically theorized that one of the reasons that the Nazis did not use an atomic weapon on London or New York was that they actually were looking at bigger and better things.
Yes, absolutely.
They were going to use atomic bombs as triggers for something even more devastating.
Oh yes, absolutely. The code classification of the Bell was Kriegsentscheidend, which in the classification scheme of Nazi Germany is the highest possible security classification for a project. In other words, the Bell was classified at a much higher level than what I believe to have been a very successful atomic bomb program on their part.
Yes.
So, you know,
didn't that classification basically mean necessary to end the war? Or
it means precisely decisive for the war. That's
decisive
correct.
Decisive for the war. Wow. And their V-1, V-2 rockets did not achieve that classification, did they?
Oh, certainly not. No. In fact, you know, I have to say something about that because, you know, in discussions with Mr. Hoagland over the past few months, I think we've both kind of come to the tentative conclusion that this idea of a two-track space program, the public one, you know, using rockets and for all intents and purposes, what is a very obsolescent technology, is the program for show, and that there is a secret program that relies upon some very avant-garde advanced technology, which, again, if we go back to Nazi Germany, you certainly have that picture with the German rockets on the one hand being kind of the public secret program, and then the Bell, which is, of course, something that nobody really even found out about until after German reunification, which would be the very secret part of the program.
Right, and even though now there are remnants of of this facility in Western Poland, there
right.
are a few documents that survived, a handful of witnesses
who right.
knew a little bit about something, but even now we really do not understand all of the details concerning the Bell.
No, we certainly don't, and it's interesting that you mentioned that facility that is in Silesia, which used to be in Germany and is now in Poland, where they tested the Bell,
mm-hmm.
because
used to be the Wenceslas
mine. Wenceslas mine, right. Well, I have heard that there has been a company that has moved in and either attempted or actually succeeded in buying that site, and they're going to destroy it.
Of course.
Of course. You know, so what else is new?
I would not be surprised to learn that it was Demolitions Incorporated or whatever the name of that company is that not only cleared away the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, but also cleared away the World Trade Center in New York. You know, we got to get rid of the evidence.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, in a certain sense, it's a little too late because a German researcher by the name of Professor Rainer Karl has actually gone to that site and taken radioactivity readings and discovered that that hinge-like structure where they tested the bell outdoors is mm-hmm. just absolutely showing all the signs of exposure to heavy neutron radiation. It's kind of a little too late to cover up a lot of stuff, but by the same token, you know, there probably is some physical evidence there that the SS, when it blew up the caves and so on to that mining facility, is still yet to be uncovered and probably never will be if this all happens.
Well, the thing that really struck me was the apparent use of just massive amounts of electricity.
Yes.
There were huge cables, and they were either had their own generating capability or were near a large generating.
Well, that is an interesting point, and let me comment on it. In Secrets of the Unified Field, I examine the fact of why the Germans would have built an entire power plant so close to those test facilities. And one of the things I conclude is that, you know, and this puts me on somewhat of a different tack than Igor Witkowski and Nick Cook and others who've investigated the bell. And that is that this shows all the signs of the Germans having required for the device large amounts of very high voltage direct current electricity. And that would explain the presence of the power plant so close, because of course anyone that works with direct current will tell you that that type of electricity dissipates very quickly over a wire from the power to the load end.
Right.
And, you know,
that's why they have booster stations.
Right, exactly. And of course with direct current, that's not really a feasible alternative. So this led me to conclude that the Nazis were in fact using two different types of electrical potentials, namely alternating and direct current. Well, lo and behold, as I'm investigating the Secrets of the Unified Field, Allende, in his marginal notes to Morris Jessup's book, actually states that an interesting phenomenon happens when you pulse the center of a magnetic vortex with lightning. And, of course, lightning is nothing but direct current electricity writ large. So, you know, where does he get that idea from? But I found it extremely interesting that the Germans are essentially rationalizing the bell so thoroughly that they've stumbled upon a similar principle.
Amazing.
Yep.
And can you speculate on what results they may have actually achieved?
Well, I think from all the indicators of the evidence, and you know, it still keeps coming in. That's why I'm writing two more books about it. But excuse me. I think what they managed to achieve at the minimum was a technology that gave a very localized manipulative ability over the fabric of space-time. In other words, they were able to create around the bell such an intense torsion field that within that field, time and space were literally altered to the point that they were able to achieve, according to some eyewitnesses who saw the device being tested, they were able to achieve a measure of levitation and so on and so forth. And of course, once we have the ability to do that, we're but a step away from being able to use the same type of fields for the creation of a massive, massive weapon. And, of course, that probably was ultimately the goal that the Nazis had in mind for the project.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible. And, of course, just to add a really bizarre note to all of this, and I think you actually speculated on this perhaps in SS Brotherhood of the Bell, the incident at Kecksburg, where a UFO landed in the woods and or appeared in the woods. It was found.
Right.
And they said it resembled an acorn,
right,
which, of course, is pretty much reminiscent of the bell shape.
Right.
Do you think it's possible that they sent something through time that appeared in, was that in the 80s when this happened?
That was in 1965, December 9th, 1965.
Okay, in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think probably what really happened is that somebody out there was testing some bell-like device, and it was probably Nazis, and that's the conclusion I'm coming to in the book I'm researching and writing right now, that the bell probably did not disappear into this country's black projects, but on the contrary, the Nazis managed to keep control over it and continued researching it. In fact, I have assembled a great deal of evidence that I now can almost conclusively say where the bell went and who was working on it.
I'm not going to wait for that. Your latest endeavor.
My latest endeavor. Yes.
But wouldn't this mean if there are Nazis hidden somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about neo-Nazis.
No, we're talking about the real hardcore stuff.
And if they're hidden away somewhere and they have the bell and they have for 60 years been working on this technology, which could supersede in devastation and magnitude hydrogen bombs,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't that give them the possible leverage needed to lord it over the nations and the political systems today?
Oh, certainly it would. And you know, that question raises a very interesting speculation. And I've pointed this out in many of my books. Carol Rosen, whose affidavit Dr. Stephen Greer has shared with the public in his Disclosure Project, was a close associate of Dr. Wernher von Braun. And according to her, he let her in on a macro scenario that was being planned by the world's movers and shakers, whoever they were. He never specified that. But in that affidavit, she maintains that he told her that the order of enemies was first going to be the Russians, then it was going to be terrorists, then it was going to be nations of concern, then it was going to be asteroids, and the final deception was going to be extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm. And invasion from space.
Right. And you know, that's an interesting thing for...
Because we're almost there.
And, yes, exactly. I mean,
Just this year now, there seems to be a growing amount of information and programming.
Right.
Larry King, for example.
Right, exactly.
Had several programs. And so it's almost like they are now conditioning us to accept the idea of life in space, something they've poo-pooed for 60 years.
Right.
But, of course, if you'll think about it, how can they make a threat from space seem credible if nobody believes there's anything out there?
Right, exactly. And by the same token, you know, if they do have a monopoly on this technology, it would be very easy to orchestrate a kind of a deceptive invasion and then, by the same token, offer the technology to repel it. So, you know,
well, false flag operations
exactly.
seem to be the tactic of the day.
Exactly, and certainly one the Nazis were very familiar with.
Right. Well, hey, it worked once before. Why won't it work again?
That's
so,
right.
So this is incredible. Unfortunately, we're out of time here.
Okay.
I'm going to have to wrap this up, but as you can tell, anyone who's listening to this program, this is fascinating material. And if you ever had the interest of trying to find out the factual matter and the scientific basis for the Philadelphia experiment or the Nazi bell or even Einstein's unified field theory, then I would strongly urge you to get Joseph P. Farrell's new book, Secrets of the Unified Field. This has been a wonderful program today, and this is your host, Jim Mars, and I'm saying adios.